Our next case is William Demont White, appellant versus State of Minnesota. File number is 821-0423. As all counsel are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes. This matter is being recorded. However, that prohibits anyone, our court rules prohibit any other recordings of this argument. We apologize for the delay. We have had some issues with Zoom this morning and the internet. Hopefully we will not have that on this case, but if we do, bear with me. So counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready, please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, and you may begin, sir.
Good morning. My name is Zach Longsdorf. I represent appellant William White. In order to succeed on a Brady claim, Mr. White has to satisfy three factors. The evidence must be favorable to him, either because it's exculpatory or impeaching. The state must have either willfully or inadvertently suppressed the evidence, and the failure to disclose must have prejudiced him. The district court concluded that the first two prongs were satisfied, but concluded that Mr. White wasn't prejudiced. It would be almost comical to think of the circumstances of this case if it didn't end with Mr. White receiving a triple upward departing 180-month sentence. He's charged with possessing a firearm after being convicted of a crime of violence. Unknown to him, but known to the prosecution, the other person in the car was also convicted of a crime of violence and is therefore also permanently ineligible to possess a firearm. Instead of disclosing that conviction or any of Viersba's convictions to Mr. White to allow him to decide how to proceed with his defense, nothing is disclosed. Then the prosecution goes into trial, eliciting testimony from Viersba to say that she's eligible to possess a firearm. And then they argue that in both closing and rebuttal. And then in affirming Mr. White's conviction, this court actually cites directly to that false testimony to explain why it was reasonable for the jury to conclude that the gun wasn't Viersba's. And so the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has said in that Kyles v. Whiteley case that if we want to figure out whether something that wasn't disclosed is material, look at how the prosecutor argues the case. And in this case, the prosecutor argued in both the closing and in the rebuttal that the jury could and should believe Jill Viersba because she could possess that gun and would have no reason to deny it if it was hers. And I think that really should tell us everything that we need to know about whether or not that terroristic threats conviction and the resulting permanent ineligibility that followed from it was material and the failure to disclose was prejudicial to Mr. White's case.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. Is this a different way of making the same argument that you made on direct appeal? And by that, I mean, if I'm looking on page 3 of White 1, where the argument on appeal was that JV's testimony was untrustworthy as a matter of law, because if the gun was hers, she could have been charged with a different crime, not ineligible, you know, ineligible to possess, which is the argument that you're making now, but carrying a firearm without a permit. So she could have been charged anyway. And the question really was, well, that wasn't the trial strategy. They knew they could have argued that, and that trial strategy was different. So isn't this the same argument, just dressed up a different way on a post-conviction petition?
I think that it's a similar argument, but I don't agree that it's the same argument. I think
earlier— Why is it different?
The reason it's different is because there's a real direct line from Viersba's ineligibility to Mr. White being acquitted that isn't necessarily there when she would have to be charged with possessing that firearm without a permit. And the reason for that is the way that this statute 624.713 in ineligibility works. There's case law, which is real clear that a defendant doesn't have to know that they can't possess a firearm in order to be charged with that. And so this isn't a scenario where we have to take an extra step and prove that she didn't have a permit or something like that. This is just a real direct line that goes, she's ineligible. She could for sure be charged with that because of the way Minnesota statute 609.713 672 works that creates an inference that the driver of a vehicle knows that there's a firearm in the car. And so that would allow a jury to convict this individual. And therefore, we have a real straight line to the accomplice scenario, which then prevents conviction without her uncorroborated testimony.
How is that meaningfully different than 624.714? I mean, if she doesn't have a permit, she doesn't have to know she doesn't have a permit. If there's no permit, she's liable under the statute. So I don't understand how the mens rea element distinguishes the type of crime for which she could have been charged had she, for purposes of accomplice liability.
So even if we assume that it, I guess we could assume that they're the same, but then my next argument on that is that unlike, presenting evidence that this individual could have been charged with not having a permit, Mr. White has a due process-based right to present evidence that would show a witness's specific reason for testifying falsely under the circumstances. And I think that's different from sort of a general credibility impeachment. And what it would be is sort of like this Davis v. Alaska, where the individual in that case was on probation and the defendant tried to use it, and ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court allowed it. Here, we have a real specific reason why this individual would potentially falsely testify about whether or not she knew that there was a firearm in that vehicle, both because she's permanently ineligible to possess a firearm because of her conviction for a crime of violence, and also because she was on probation both at the time of the offense and at the time of trial. And the way I think really we can look at that is there's the Sarber case and the Soriano Clemente case from Mr. White's brief. And the way that I think those fit here is that they're both cases that deal with what happens when the prosecution fails to disclose evidence related to the primary accuser's credibility that really is material. And in the Sarber case, I think is really apt because it involved two people who were in a car where contraband was found. And the way that worked is Corwin was the driver, and he said that this meth belonged to Sarber and testified that way at trial. And then after trial, Sarber learned that Corwin had previously been arrested for a controlled substance violation and had worked to become an informant to avoid being charged. And so Sarber then filed a petition for post-conviction relief, and the district court denied it, but this court overturned, and they say that essentially Corwin is the state's entire case here, and the fact that he had expressed a desire to work with law enforcement to avoid a prior charge was material to Sarber's defense. And I really think we have a similar circumstance to that here, where we have two people in a car where contraband is found. And as in Sarber, nobody but the occupants of the vehicles knows where the contraband came from. And so with the DNA being inconclusive, and then everyone else who testifies doesn't actually know where the gun came from, really the prosecution's entire case here is Viersba saying, well, it's not my gun, and so it has to be Mr. White's. And I think we can sort of see that if we look at the prosecution's
closing arguments. No, but I'd like to, Mr. Longstorff, I'd like to touch on that. I mean, looking at her testimony, I mean, Ms. Viersba was your client's best friend at trial. I mean, looking at her testimony on page 6 of respondent's brief, I mean, she's backing him up. You told police you never saw Willie with a gun. Absolutely. You told law enforcement, you swore in your dead mother's grave, you never saw him with a gun. Is that right? Yes. You told him you never saw him go to the glove box. Yes. You'd hear it if it was shut, you'd hear that, the click. Did you hear that? No. I mean, apart from, the whole trial strategy of, not being, too hot and too cold with this person, I mean, I fail to see how this would have changed anything at trial. I mean, this client was unbelievably helpful. Excuse me. This witness was unbelievably helpful to your client.
Well, she was helpful in some respects, Your Honor, but I think during his testimony at the evidentiary hearing, appellate counsel really laid it out clearly when he said, Viersba had some parts of her testimony that was helpful, but overall her testimony is more harmful to Mr. White. And that's because or even though she says, I didn't see him with a gun, she does say, I was in there earlier in the day or the day before, and there was no gun. I'm the only one with access to this car. He had to put it there. I didn't do it. He had to put him there. And really, I think appellate counsel in his testimony at the evidentiary hearing says that if you could essentially get rid of Viersba's testimony that says, well, it has to be Mr. White, then all that's really proven is that Mr. White was in a vehicle because Officer Warnimi saw him in it, that later a gun was found in. And I think if you could do that, then there's insufficient evidence to convict him of being in possession of that firearm. And so I do think that ultimately her testimony is the thing that allowed Mr. White to be convicted, because if the jury doesn't believe her, we really have DNA that can't exclude either person. Nobody who testified aside from White or Viersba knows how that gun got there. And even the only law enforcement officer, I think, who actually saw Mr. White in the vehicle was Warrenimi. And so
that's not entirely fair, because when you look at the circumstances proved, as were set forth in the first White decision, there's some other evidence there that would exculpate JV. For example, when the police officer approached the car, when the police officer discovered the gun, she was surprised. And then she volunteered to allow her car to be searched. If she knew that a gun were in the glove compartment, she would not volunteer to have her car searched.
Well, that's potentially the case, but I do think that the jury made that conclusion under in this case without having knowledge of this person's criminal history, which I do think goes directly to her credibility and specifically to whether or not she could claim that gun that was in her car, as the prosecution argued in its closing. And I think really this terroristic, you know, if we're talking about her credibility, there's really reason to question that, because it stems from this terroristic threats conviction that came about as part of a plot to have a law enforcement officer killed. And then it's not as if this person didn't have, you know, then had many years without convictions, so she wouldn't know that she's ineligible or isn't on probation. She continued to be convicted on a regular basis of things like theft, DUI. There's a note in the prosecutor's notes from his meeting with her, but about a false information to police that Mr. White's never been able to find out about. But I think there's plenty of reason to question this person's subjective credibility. And really, I think that that's sort of what this comes down to, is that the prosecution has submitted that, well, even, you know, even if Viersba's ineligible, which I think they finally admitted in their brief that she is, that we should just believe that she was telling the truth and believe she was in her testimony, so there can't be any prejudice. But I do think that that ignores that there's plenty of reason to question her credibility, especially since one of the convictions that Mr. White found out about, there was a police report attached that showed that Viersba had denied knowledge of marijuana that was found inside her own purse. And I think those are exactly the sort of things that the cases like Sarber and Soriano Clemente show, that when there's suppressedness that really goes toward the accuser's credibility in a material way, there's prejudice in the failure to disclose. And we have that here, where Viersba, despite saying, I didn't see White put the gun in there, she is the main accuser, because she says, although she is not actually the owner of the car, she claims to have exclusive control over it and says that he has to be the one that put it in there. I didn't do it, he did it, he's the only one that could. But what Mr. White didn't know about at trial, and what the jury never heard about, and I think Mr. White would have a due process right to present at least the terroristic threats conviction and the permanent ineligibility, and the fact that Viersba was on probation both at the time of the offense and trial, but there's also the theft convictions, the DUI convictions, and the deal with the contraband in her purse. And I do, you know, I think that this case, what this case really is a Brady case, but I do think that the facts also support granting relief on an ineffective assistance claim if counsel wouldn't have used it. And I know there's this argument that it's strategy and we can't review it, but I think that's a misapplication of United States Supreme Court and Minnesota Supreme Court ineffective assistance of counsel precedent, because both of those courts have held that strategic decisions need to be reasonable under the circumstances to receive the great level of deference that we're talking about. And what's going on here is that I think trial counsel ignores that Viersba's testimony is actually more harmful to White than it is beneficial, because if he can avoid having her testimony be relied upon, then a jury can't convict him, because the only thing that's proved is that he's in a car where a gun was later found. And this evidence of ineligibility, I think there's a real direct line toward doing that, because I think it's indisputed that she's ineligible. I think her lack of knowledge of ineligibility is irrelevant to that. And if you could get that accomplice instruction, if we look through this record, there really isn't anything that corroborates that by and large, because all we could say then is essentially, if we don't have Viersba's testimony, it's just a guess who that gun belongs to. And for that reason, we'd ask that the court vacate Mr. White's conviction.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, my name is Kyle Triggs. I represent the respondent of the state of Minnesota, and I am asking this court to affirm Mr. White's conviction. We recognize there was a failure to disclose, but our position is that it did not result in unfair prejudice that would entitle Mr. White to a new trial. And the reason we don't believe that is because, number one, the terroristic threats conviction, even when we account for the unpublished cases, there is no reasonable probability that the mere existence of this conviction created a subjective motive for Ms. Viersba to falsely deny possession of the gun. To the contrary, the record involves discharge paperwork, which affirmatively advised her of the 10-year ban, which would run contrary to the theory that a firearm ban was on Ms. Viersba's mind when she denied knowing about the gun. We would furthermore point out that this is not a case where an accomplice liability, the accomplice testimony rule, I should say, would have changed the outcome. It is, as the Attorney General had pointed out in their brief, this is not a case where there's evidence of Ms. Viersba knowing the appellant was a felon and giving him the handgun in an aiding and abetting theory. To any extent that the defense has referred to Ms. Viersba as someone who could have possessed the gun in order to prove his innocence, that's been more in the lines of an alternative perpetrator theory, especially since the trial. But beyond that, even if we were to apply the accomplice liability rule, as one of your honors pointed out, there's other circumstances that are consistent with her testimony that restore confidence in the conviction. And on that point, I wanted to emphasize one thing. Mr. Longsdorf had indicated that the Court of Appeals had relied on Ms. Viersba's eligibility comment, which they did cite that in the context of accomplice liability. But when they talked about the circumstances supporting the conviction in the sufficiency of the evidence section, when I read their list of circumstances proved, there was no reference to that eligibility comment from my review. And moreover, what they do refer to is his conduct surrounding the offense, including him directing Ms. Viersba to park the vehicle away from the scene. We have the fact that Mr. White was made aware of a shooting through his son and is picking up his son after learning of the shooting, which provides a pertinent motive for him to possess a gun. When you compare that to Ms. Viersba, her only role is driving him there at his request. That is the sole reason she's there. She has no other connection. There's no other motive for her to be possessing the gun. We have the fact that an officer described her as extremely cooperative and then very clearly visibly upset, which supports the inference that she's genuinely shocked. Although Ms. Stemmis's opinion is not evidence at trial, it's noteworthy that Ms. Stemmis testified that when she's looking for ways to defend Mr. White at trial, when she watched Ms. Viersba's reaction, she thought it was a very credible reaction, or at least that a jury would definitely find that it was a credible reaction. So, obviously that's not evidence at trial, but it is consistent with the officer's testimony, who described her reaction as shock. On top of that, we have Mr. White interfering with the investigation, profusely sweating, after law enforcement had searched the car and discovered the gun. On that point, I want to address another argument that Mr. Longsdorf made in his brief. He contends that the only reason Mr. White was sweating was because the police allegedly turned up the heat to get his DNA. Again, even if we are assuming that the accomplice testimony rule applies. In that analysis, we interpret the evidence in the light most favorable to the state. So we are not obligated to accept as true this alternative reason that Mr. White is sweating. We look at this in together with the rest of the evidence, and the rest of the evidence I just cited, the motive to bring the gun, the fact that he directs Ms. Fierce to park the car away from the scene because he wants to go confront the police, but yet it's consistent with him not wanting them to go near the car. And we have the rest of the evidence in the case. We have
Mr. Triggs, here's my concern, speaking for myself and not the panel. I get the arguments that, you know, they were trying to, you know, treat her with kid gloves. But how do we know? I mean, if they had known, and let's assume the fact that she was ineligible to possess a gun, I mean, isn't it likely that in that instance, you know, apart from, okay, now we're going to sort of treat her with kid gloves because she helps us sometimes, she doesn't sometimes. I mean, the other logical strategy would have been attacker full force. She's the one who had the gun. And then when she denies it on the stand, impeach her and say, well, you know, you were prohibited from passing a gun, and then dump it all on her. I mean, it seems to me that's a likely result or strategy that was foreclosed because of the Brady violation. And I don't know what would have happened then. What's your response to that, Mr. Triggs?
I would cite Ms. Stemmes' testimony that even if she had known about the conviction, she would not have used it. And I would also point out, Your Honor, you know, the mere fact that the conviction exists doesn't ultimately answer the question of whether Ms. Viersba, whether this gave Ms. Viersba a subjective motive to lie, particularly when the paperwork she was given advised her that her rights were restored, number one, and two, that within 10 years, this firearm restriction would end, which would the 10-year mark being years before this offense.
Why is it that trial counsel's sort of after the fact explanation of her strategy is even relevant here? I mean, to sort of piggyback on what Judge Connolly is asking, I feel as the troubling thing about this case is that all of this evidence was not disclosed to the defendant such that he was unable to develop a strategy with the benefit of this evidence. And now after the fact, he's saying, well, if I would have had that evidence, I would have pursued a different trial strategy, notwithstanding whatever my counsel says. I would have fired her if she refused to go along with my strategy. So when that evidence, that critical evidence, is withheld from the defendant, why isn't that prejudicial?
Your Honor, I definitely agree. The evidence should have been disclosed without question. There was no excuse for that. In terms of why we don't believe Mr. White when he says, I was going to totally change my strategy, is not just merely the hindsight factor, but more importantly, this case is, we can look at the facts of this case and more particularly the conduct of Mr. White as a client. And it is, as counsel has testified, both his trial counsel and even his appellate attorney, he is very active in his case in that when he wants to look into something, he is very, very outspoken. Now, it's not to say that a client has an obligation to research things that his attorney should be researching. We're not saying Mr. White had that obligation, but it just so happens he was very, very proactive when he wanted to know whether a witness had a history or he wanted something looked into. He was very, very clear about that with his attorneys. And notably, Ms. Stemmes essentially testified that for how outspoken he was, there was no discussion of attacking or fixating on Ms. Viersba. So even though they didn't have the terroristic threats conviction, you have evidence that's very telling that there's all these requests to look into this and look into that, and yet no request to look into Viersba. And I think that's relevant to this case. Every case is different. And I think that's a fair statement. The point Your Honor is making it could very well be true in cases where a client is just quiet, even when they want something, they don't speak up. I think we have to look at the circumstances of each case. But as the district court,
they don't know what they don't know. That's the problem. They don't know what they don't know, what hasn't been disclosed to them. So they don't have the benefit of all the information in order to make a fully informed decision about trial strategy. I mean, the things that you're pointing to now, Mr. Triggs, indicate to me that this client was well engaged in his defense. And if he didn't like the way that his counsel was representing him, he says now, and I, based on what you're saying, it seems to be credible that he would have fired his counsel and pursued the strategy that he thought was most beneficial to him, which would be to attack her credibility. And so I just don't know why prejudice doesn't exist under those circumstances when he's deprived of the opportunity to make a fully informed decision about his own defense.
What I would say, Your Honor, is the reason why prejudice does not exist is even if it were true that he would have wanted to use it, we ultimately still have the question of is there a reasonable likelihood that would have changed the outcome? And we get back to the question of, does her history create a motive to lie? And for the reasons I explained before, no. I mean, it's the subjective state of mind that matters. And as for her remaining convictions, I want to reiterate those convictions. When I'm talking about the misdemeanor thefts and whatnot, those have no relevance. To the contrary, they're inadmissible character smearing evidence that are being offered by the defense merely to show propensity. So those would not have been admissible, even if they wanted to use those. And as the district court found with respect to the probationary status, Ms. Viersba was not reporting to a probation agent. And that's very, very critical. When we talk about her testimony that she wasn't on probation, it was in the context of an officer saying, should I go through your agent to get your DNA? It is in that context where she says, I'm not even on probation. And it was established that she was not reporting to an agent. So that strongly negates the idea that she has a subjective, probation to the court creates a subjective motive to lie, in the same way the mere existence of this terroristic threats conviction creates a subjective motive to lie. There's no reasonable support for either when we look at the end of the day, even if the defense had pursued it at trial. And the case law that Mr. Longsdorf cited, the Sarber and the Soriano Clemente, there's two key distinctions in each of those cases. In Sarber, there was a bargain that the defense did not know about, a bargain that can have an impact on a subjective motive to testify one way or another. This record contains, there's no bargain here where, hey, Ms. Viersba, you tell us that no one else other than Mr. White could have put the gun in the car, then, you know, we'll give you this deal. So that's a distinction. The other distinction in Soriano is, in Soriano, the evidence in question there was very admissible and pertinent to dishonesty. It was impeachable offenses, including perjury, using different names and birth dates, multiple prior convictions for crimes of dishonesty, the kind of evidence that would have been admissible under 609. Those are critical distinctions in the cases that Mr. Longsdorf just cited. So, I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, and I make this very clear, is even if the court does not agree that, or even the court finds that Mr. White would have changed his trial strategy, again, we still have the same problem. Is there a reasonable probability this strategy would have changed the outcome? And the answer is no, because there's not only do we have Ms. Viersba's testimony, we have evidence supporting her testimony. And so it is for that ultimate reason, whether he's choosing an alternative perpetrator theory or in a contradictory fashion, trying to get the accomplice liability instruction, in either case, there is enough evidence to support the conviction. And that's why I'm asking this court to affirm it. And with that, unless there's other questions, I would yield my time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Triggs. Mr. Longsdorf, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you. I would just note, counsel just closed up talking about Rule 609 and impeachment, and certainly these convictions would have a role in impeaching this witness, But we're talking about something more than that. Mr. White has an affirmative due process right to present evidence which would show why a witness would have potential bias in testifying falsely. And I think during the evidentiary hearing, even the trial prosecutor agreed that a witness who was ineligible to possess a firearm would have a reason not to acknowledge it, or that a witness who was on probation would have a reason not to acknowledge a firearm. So I don't think there's anything controversial about that. But getting to
would it have made a difference? I mean, your choice, the trial counsel's choice was, okay, I've got the witness who said what she said, you know, which was pretty good, versus, okay, now I can attack her. You know, now let's assume she was ineligible and she gets on the stand and says, no, it's not my gun. You can impeach her with that, but she's still denying it's the gun and she's saying it's your client's gun. But you get to impeach her. I mean, it seems to me, if my choice is she's going to sink me, but I can impeach her, versus she's saying, oh my God, he never touched a gun, I think I would rather have the first one. I mean, so if I'm right, then how does this would have made a difference?
I think the reason that it is prejudicial, there's kind of two direct ways you can get there. That Viersba's testimony is ultimately the reason that Mr. White is convicted. Even though she says good things about him, the fact is that when she says it's my car, no one else can be in it, I didn't put the gun there, I know it wasn't there yesterday, it's got to be his, that's the thing that convicts him. And so if you can attack that in any way, and I think that Mr. White would have done that had he known that. And I think that, I mean, the fact that he discharged trial counsel, discharged an appointed attorney during post-trial motions because they didn't agree with him. And then he actually argued pro se during the post-trial motions, the reason I got convicted is because I have a record and she doesn't, and that it's reasonable that it's her gun, shows that he would have went, I mean, full attack mode on that. And I don't think Mr. White, like we talked about in his brief, I don't think he would have testified. I think that he gets an accomplice instruction and then he relies on the fact that there's very little corroborating evidence. And ultimately, the fact that we continue to come back to this witness's subjective credibility, I think, explains exactly why there's prejudice to Mr. White under these circumstances. If this court needs to believe that that witness was telling the truth to uphold the conviction, that's a problem. If the jury needed to believe that that witness was telling the truth in order to uphold the conviction, that's a problem, particularly where the evidence shows that the prosecutor at trial knew about these convictions, had a plan going into trial to ask these questions of her about her eligibility, elicited the testimony, never disclosed it to Mr. White, despite the fact that it was clearly known. And I would just note that the Mitchell case cited in Mr. White's brief, that office had actually precluded a defendant from using a probation discharge order with almost the exact same language in it to argue that he didn't know he should be ineligible. So I think this is something they knew about going into that. And ultimately, Mr. White was deprived of the opportunity to present the defense in the way he wanted to present it because this stuff wasn't disclosed to him. And I think counsel has agreed that it's very clearly stuff that should have been disclosed. There was no excuse for it. And ultimately, the only real question left is there prejudice? And I think that comes down to two questions. Is the evidence admissible? And could it change the outcome? And if this person could be an accomplice, then you can rely on that and then argue, well, there isn't enough corroborating evidence, because ultimately, if you take her out, there isn't more evidentiary support for that gun belonging to her than to him, and that's not enough evidence to convict. And so that's why we believe that Mr. White was convicted here. And as far as her credibility, I would just note, despite the claim that Viersba was so helpful and confident with the police when the officers first approached, that she flung the door open in a way that the officers said was dangerous and put him in sort of a death tunnel or something like that, where he was afraid he would get shot. So I don't think it's all that clear that she was happy-go-lucky, happy to be part of it to begin with. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Longsdorf. Thank you very much, Mr. Triggs. The matter is submitted and we will issue our opinion. within 90 days. We'll move on to the last case.